Good afternoon. This is Carol Bond reading today with you the August 25th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll begin with a few articles on the front page that have to do with education. The first one is entitled Alternative Education Center Begins Its First GED Classes, and this was written by Valerie Wells. James Gorsuch works with junior high age kids at GT Church, and one of his oft-repeated pieces of advice for them is to stay in school and finish their education. "It's hard to get them to listen to me when I haven't done that myself," said James, who is remedying that by signing up for adult education classes at the Alternative Education Center in the former Decatur Area Technical Academy building at El Dorado and Jackson Streets downtown. Monday was the first day of classes at the center, which also houses Milliken Academy Safe School on the second floor. The GED exam is different from its former incarnation and costs $125 now, so students want to be prepared before they take it. "There was a time," said Rocky Wilkerson, director, "that people might stay in GED prep classes for months or even years, but funding depends on measurable results now, and the results the state wants to see are students who move quickly and efficiently from level to level, with the ultimate goal post-secondary education and a job. For adults who have been away from the classroom for years, in some cases, that may mean some catch-up work is needed. In adult basic education, students bring up their reading, writing, and math skills. Evidence-based reading instruction, for those whose reading level is below ninth grade, has been very successful," said Bobby Farrison, who teaches that class. "It is the neatest thing I've ever learned how to do," Farrison said. "It breaks down reading into components to help students with their weak areas. One area is vocabulary, which is a biggie. I do assessments on the students on vocabulary, comprehension, fluency, and word pronunciation, and I see what they need to work on, and most students need to work on vocabulary. Without those skills, struggling readers can't keep track of what they've read or read smoothly enough to understand and learn from it," she said. "I tell them no one is born a great reader. We all have to develop it," she said. Students who are already at ninth grade and better can take prep classes online independently, said Lynn Malachowski, who oversees that class. "And when they're ready, they can take a practice test to see if they're ready for the real thing." Erica Russell Smith has a son who is incarcerated, and one of her reasons for signing up for classes is to provide him with an example so he'll pursue his GED when he's released, she said. But she also wants to advance her education for herself. "I need a GED," she said. "I figured if I can show him I can get mine, he'll be more motivated to get his. I'm hoping to have a job when I leave here. I want to be a certified nurse assistant." Another article about education has this headline: Johns Hill Lego Robotics Team Programmed for Fun, and this was written by Valerie Wells. Last year's star programmers for Johns Hill Magnet School's Lego League robotics team have moved on to high school. "Everybody's on the same page," said Liz Bartimus, who is the faculty advisor for the team, we're all learning. Learning and fun are the main purposes of the team, she said to the students who attended the organizational meeting Monday. Winning is not. It's fun to win, and a collection of trophies in her classroom show that the team has had success in the past. But if they don't win, it's okay. We're proud of you, and we're going to be proud of you regardless, she said. Lego League is a robotics competition in which students build and program a robot to do a specific task using parts from a kit provided to them in competition with other students their age at local, regional, and national levels, if they get that far. It takes creativity and hard work. Bartimus told the students that they'd have to make the same commitment they would to an athletic team, but their studies come first. If they fall behind, they can bring their work to meetings or spend lunch with her or come in before school for help, because she doesn't want their grades to slip either. The way Lego League works is all the teams get the challenge the same day, and this year that's today at 11 a.m. local time. A couple of teaser videos have been available online, so they know it has something to do with trash and recycling. Three members return from last year's team, and one of those, Joe Tolliday, is willing to take on programming. He said he doesn't know anything about it, but it's a challenge he wants to tackle. The team also has the benefit of two Caterpillar Incorporated engineers who will provide guidance and advice. I've heard so much stuff about classmate Alex Peters and his brother, who was in Lego League for a long time, said Weston Thompson, a sixth grader. I thought, well, I'll give it a shot and see what happens, really where it brings me. Weston has a humongous box of Legos at home, he said. Alex is another who is willing to give programming a try after watching his brother's involvement with the team. I got to see what they were building, and I thought it was pretty cool, he said. Teresa Churchill writes this article. It's headlined, Little Free Libraries Continue to Pop Up in Community. A reward waited right outside for Maya Barbie, age 5, who hung out in the Decatur Family YMCA's child care center this summer while her dad exercised elsewhere in the building. On the way to the car, father and daughter would stop at the Little Free Library, painted with characters from Dr. Seuss's children's book, where the girl would leave a book she was finished with and find a different one to take home. Not long ago, she chose My Daddy, Caillou, written by Christine Lheureux and illustrated by Hélène Desputeau. I like it because it has fathers in it, Maya said. I think it's cool, said her dad, Larnell Barbie. She likes to read, so why not switch her books with theirs? More and more readers are asking that question as more and more little free libraries continue to pop up in the Decatur area. The pair at the YMCA, one out front with Dr. Seuss characters, and one beside the Camp Sokia Pavilion north of the building and painted with minions, are but the latest examples of a trend begun locally by Judy Sell, who planted the first small outdoor library on a stick outside her South Shore's home at 75 Phillips Drive in October 2013. When Keith Warlin, Youth and Family Director at the YMCA, proposed installing one in time for the start of Camp Sokia in June, Operations Director Don Stoltz suggested a second one for the rest of the Y's customers. Becky Smith, a former lifeguard and a member of the Camp Sokia staff, painted them both. "We thought it was a good fit because we have such a push for literacy in our summer camp and after school program," Warland said. "It's taking off a lot faster than I expected it to." Todd Bowl started the Little Free Library movement in 2009 when he built one that looked like a one-room schoolhouse in Hudson, Wisconsin, as a tribute to his mother. The goal quickly became to build as many little libraries as Andrew Carnegie constructed full-size ones, 2,510, a target surpassed in August of 2012. Indeed, there are more than 10 times that number of registered Little Free Libraries in the world today, most of them in the United States. The concept is for people to leave a book and take a book with no deadlines or fines to interfere with the pleasure of reading. Pam Smith of 2530 South Forest Crest Road was apparently the second Decatur resident to put up a library after receiving a barn-style model for Christmas in 2013. She and Sal say their libraries receive daily visits, that children's books are the most popular, and that they are happy the number of little libraries is multiplying in Macon County. "I had one lady from Florida come to see mine while she was in the area visiting family," Smith said. The Barclay Public Library District just replaced the boxes on the four Little Free Libraries it has maintained for a little over a year. Two are at Casey's General Stores, one at West Mound Road and North Taylorville Avenue in Decatur, and the other at 150 South Illinois 121 in Warrensburg, a third at Harristown Elementary School, and a fourth at the Firehouse in Latham. Library Director Lacey Wright said the original boxes did not stand up to the weather, but the new ones, built by Paul Wells of Decatur and painted by teen volunteers, including Whitney Meltz, Lacey Edwards, Sky Williams, and Michaela Craw, should keep the books inside contained and dry. So far, the little libraries in Decatur and Harristown are used the most, Wright said. A Little Free Library installed at the Dennis School Garden in the spring of 2014 was moved this spring to the home of its builder, John Larcher, who lives at 1679 West Main Street. "It's getting a little bit more traffic all the time," Larcher said. Matt Andrews, principal of Dennis School, said the library got a lot of use by the students, but the box kept getting separated from the post either by the wind or by vandals when it was at the school's garden. Laurel Laurie, meanwhile, has had a Little Free Library at her home at 1651 North Gregory Street since her daughter and son-in-law gave her one for Mother's Day. Her son-in-law, George Mackey of St. Paul, Minnesota, fashioned it out of parts from an old dresser. "They have one and told me how much fun they were having with it," Laurie said. "I'm an old retired teacher and like to promote reading." Laurie's desire is a trait Little Free Librarians seem to share, one that often leads them to add their own books to their libraries whenever the inventory runs low. I probably spend $50 a month at the monthly Friends of the Decatur Public Library used book sale, Sel said. It's for a good cause, is how I look at it. Franklin School fourth grader Brianna McDermott, 9, said she spent a lot of time browsing the little free library at Camp Sokia this summer. You can walk right up and get what you want to read, she said. Books tell stories about things I may not know about. Next, we'll turn to an article from the Lee News Service, and the dateline is Marshall. The headline reads, Martinsville farmer was checking crops when plane crashed. Preliminary results from an autopsy indicate that a Clark County farmer died from injuries that he suffered when his airplane crashed into one of his fields this weekend. Clark County Coroner Jeff Pierce said the body of David Goodwin, 63, of Martinsville, was found in the wreckage of his plane at 4 p.m. Saturday. He said Goodwin was checking on his crops when the plane crashed into a bean field south of Martinsville at a site north of 700 Road and east of 1100 Street. Goodwin's family contacted authorities Saturday morning to report that he was missing, Pierce said. The coroner said members of the Civil Air Patrol conducted an aerial search, found the wreckage, and directed emergency responders to the scene. Pierce said he is still waiting on the final results of the autopsy to be completed for Goodwin, who was flying alone at the time of the crash. The Federal Aviation Administration sent investigators to the scene and has turned the case over to the National Transportation Safety Board. The NTSB reported that a preliminary report on this crash involving a Cessna 172 will be posted on its website, www.ntsb.gov, within 7 to 10 days. The Clark County Sheriff's Office reported that the Martinsville Police Department and the Martinsville Fire Protection District assisted with the response to the crash, which happened about a quarter mile into the bean field. We turn now to the obituaries. Jonathan Allen Drake, 28, of Decatur, passed away unexpectedly at 10:09 a.m. on Friday, August 21st, at St. Mary's Hospital, Decatur. A celebration of his life will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, August 26th, at Heartland Community Church, 3253 Brush College Road, Decatur. Pastor Joe Bowman will officiate. Burial will follow at North Fork Cemetery, Long Creek. Visitation will be held Tuesday, August 25th, that's today, from 5 to 8 p.m., also in the church. Casual attire. Memorial donations to the American Lung Association, Tanzias Logan Funeral Service and Care, is in charge of arrangements. Amy S. Jameson, 43, of Ivesdale, Illinois, passed away on Friday, August 21st, at the Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, August 26th, from 5 p.m. to 7 at the Rue Hines Funeral Home, 348 North Piatt Street, Bement, Illinois. Funeral services will be held on Thursday, August 27th at 1 p.m., also at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Bement Township Cemetery, Bement. Memorial contributions can be made to the Amy S. Jamison Memorial Fund to go towards helping with funeral expenses. Vernon McCoy, 85, of Mount Auburn, passed away Thursday, August 20th, at his residence in Mount Auburn. He was born April 12, 1930, in Marion, Illinois. Funeral services will be held Thursday, August 27th at 10 a.m. at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville, with Pastor Tim Motes officiating. Burial will be in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Mount Auburn. Visitation will be held Wednesday, August 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville. Thomas E. Polk, Sr., 84, of Mount Pulaski, passed away at 3:28 p.m. Saturday, August 22nd, at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Services for Tom will be at 4 p.m. Wednesday, August 26th, at Frick Calvert Schrader Funeral Home in Mount Pulaski, Illinois, with Stephen Collins officiating. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m., 2 hours prior to the service. Memorials may be made to the family of Thomas Polk, Sr. Burial at Mount Pulaski Cemetery will be held at a later date. Next, let's read an article about crime, which is actually from Bloomington, written by Edith Brady Lunny, Lee News Service writer. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers is asking that the attorney hired by Kirk Zimmerman to defend him on murder charges be disqualified because of an alleged conflict dating back to the early stages of the investigation. Kirk Zimmerman, 56, was charged in July with first-degree murder related to the November shooting death of his ex-wife, Pamela Zimmerman, in her East Side office. The 53-year-old victim and Maroa Forsyth High School graduate worked as a financial planner and certified public accountant. In a motion, the state argued that Bloomington lawyer Stephanie Wong be barred because she and other lawyers with her firm, Steve Skelton and Josh Rinker, each represented potential witnesses and Zimmerman during the investigation. The motion outlines the alleged conflicts, starting with a November 10th interview by Bloomington police of Eldon Whitlow, identified as a client of Pamela Zimmerman's financial consulting firm. Skelton attended that interview with Whitlow, the motion stated. The state claims that a December 12th police interview with Scott Baldwin, Pamela Zimmerman's fiancé, was attended by Rinker, who told police he was there because Wong was unavailable. Wong and Baldwin talked on the phone for an hour before he went to meet with police, according to prosecutors. Chambers' office maintains the law firm's involvement also includes Skelton's presence with a friend of the victim, Lee DeYoung, during a January 17th police interview. On May 15th, Kirk Zimmerman and his girlfriend were seen entering the law firm's office and staying for 1.5 hours after he was served with a search warrant for his car, court documents stated. Wong also was with Kirk Zimmerman at a July 31st arraignment, where he pleaded not guilty to the charges. He remains in jail in lieu of posting $500,000 bond. Chambers said Monday the request to remove Wong will be discussed at a hearing today. We want to make sure all the information is out there for the court and the defendant to be aware of any conflict. We want to make sure this case is tried only once, said Chambers. We have time for one or two letters to Dear Abby. This is written, of course, by Jean Phillips. Dear Abby, I have been married for 36 years to a woman who is a pediatric physical therapist. A number of her youngsters are disabled or abused, and their lives can be a struggle. This results in emotional, intense work days for my wife. She brings these stories home and shares them with me. Over the years, on three or four occasions, I have either told her I didn't care to hear an emotional story that day, or ignored her when she tried to tell me. The last time I said it was last year, and now she refuses to tell me anything about her workload. She's very stubborn, and although I am interested in what she does, she won't let me apologize. She says she will discuss it only with her fellow therapists at work. Abby, what can I do to convey to her that I do want to share her experiences? This is signed Regretful in Georgia. Dear Regretful, if you haven't been able to get through to your wife by now, probably there's not much you can do. There's a saying that a joy shared is twice a joy, and a burden shared is half a burden. When she tried to confide what was weighing on her mind or heart on those occasions, your response was frankly unkind. Further, if the treatment she's giving those children is covered by HIPAA regulations, it's possible that the only people she should talk to about them are her colleagues. I wish I could be more helpful, but it looks like you may have to find another way to be intimate with your wife besides discussing her workload. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the August 25th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.